Our first speaker this morning will be Glenn Stanton, who will speak to us on manhood is not natural, why it's in bad shape, and how to recover it. He is the director of family formation studies at Focus on the Family, and he debates and lectures extensively on the issues of gender, sexuality, marriage, and parenting at universities and churches around the world. He has also served in the George W. Bush administration for many years as a consultant on increasing fathers' involvement in the Head Start program. He is the author of 8 books on marriage and families and a regular columnist for various blogs. His latest book, Loving My LGBT Neighbor, Being Friends in Grace and Truth, explores how Christians should interact with gay or lesbian neighbors in a Christ-honoring way. Please join me in welcoming Glenn Stanton. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Good morning. Thank you for that introduction, James. And I want to bring greetings to my brothers and sisters in Christ, including, but also, the Lutherans and the Episcopalians. These ecumenical things can be very, very fun. So, what I'm going to speak about this morning is, as we said, manhood. And manhood, not from a theological perspective so much, but from a sociological and anthropological, and kind of lay that foundation for the rest of the day, understanding the essence of manhood, and to remind us that sort of our Western ideal in modernity of manhood is really quite unnatural in a sense. I want to look at manhood from across the experience of humanity and human experience from the anthropological position. It's interesting, our dear Harvey Mansfield, political professor at Harvard, wrote a number of years ago a book on manliness. I love the boldness of that title. And he at the very beginning says, and let me add as well, Harvey Mansfield was Jordan Peterson before Jordan Peterson was Jordan Peterson. You know, talking about and being an advocate for manliness and masculinity. And he says in the first 3 lines of his book, he says, straight out, this book is about manliness. What is that? Well, it's good to start from examples that we know. And the first one he gives is Margaret Thatcher. I love that. So in a way, manliness can be a characteristic that is not necessarily confined to those people with certain body parts. Few would disagree that manhood is in crisis today. Men are falling behind women in many extremely important measures of personal and social well-being. This is well documented in many books like Hannah Rosen's The End of Man. In deeply consequential ways, they are becoming the weaker sex, beanpole weaker, as we will look at. Some women celebrate this. Most, however, are deeply concerned, especially since the weakness of men in their lives increasingly makes it difficult for women to accomplish 2 of their great and deeply desired life wishes, that is, becoming wives and mothers. Women everywhere will naturally desire that. Even if they're career women, well-educated, going out in the world making a difference, most of them desire to become wives and mothers. The equation is really simple, though. If boys don't become good, dependable men, they cannot become good, dependable husbands and fathers. It's not that there are not enough males for these young women today. It's the shortage of men, and there's a great difference there. If they cannot find reliable, marriageable men with a future, then what they will do is often settle for sub-good choices. Thus, it's no coincidence that the two fastest growing family trends today are unmarried cohabitation and out-of-wedlock childbearing, not among teens, but about older 20 and 30-something women. If I can't find a husband, I'll at least live with a guy, and at least I'll have a baby daddy. This is significant, and it's not coincidental. The causes of these trends can be found in the underappreciated and often strenuously denied, as none of us doubt, distinct natures of manhood and womanhood. It is found in this strange but essential anthropological truth. Womanhood is natural, manhood is not. Womanhood is a natural phenomenon. A female's own biological makeup usually ensures that she will grow into a healthy woman. Leave her to herself, and she is much more likely than the male to move into mature adulthood. It's why the phrase, woman up, be a woman, make a woman out of her, those phrases do not exist. As her body matures internally and externally, it sends her and those around her an unmistakable message about what she is and what she is becoming. It moves her inexorably in that direction with a force as great as it is mysterious. Few girls miss these cues. It's not just her body that is changing. She is, by nature, becoming a different person. Her family and her community treat her different as a consequence of this. A father shudders at it as it forever changes his interaction with his little girl. I'm a father of four girls. I know this all too well. Women must be taught with great political and ideological pressure to ignore their womanhood, to abandon their children, for doing so is absolutely contrary to their nature. This political and ideological effort, of course, is what we ironically call radical feminism. And Chesterton defines feminism as that effort to deny everything that is feminine. I think he's right. The opposite is true of manhood. Manhood is not natural. It does not occur naturally. It is socially and must be socially constructed. This is the foundation of my talk this morning. As George Gilder, and if you're interested in this topic and have never read George Gilder's Men and Marriage, don't go read it right now, but later tonight, order the book, get it, study it, especially like the first three chapters. As George Gilder explains boldly and pointedly in Men and Marriage, unlike a woman, a man has no civilized role or agenda inscribed in his body. Let me repeat that again. Unlike a woman, a man has no civilized role or agenda inscribed in his body. The boy has no onboard GPS directing him toward his future. His manhood does not exist within himself as womanhood does. It is out there behind him, beyond himself. He must go in search of it. He must rouse himself up, gather his courage. And as Patrick McCaskey will tell us later on today, he must gird his loins to move out. Manhood is an action. We must note this. His movement into manhood can only come into being with a pilot, with a director, with a guide to point him toward his destiny. Go out there, young man, and get it. Doing this is the significant, intentional work of the older men around him, starting with his father. As a behavior and status, manhood must be learned, earned, demonstrated, and proven by the growing of the boy over the years. It is a process. It is not an event, if you will. As an identity, manhood must be and can only be bestowed by the man's father and the larger fraternity of men around him. It can only be bestowed by other men. His mother can only affirm it. She cannot bequeath it. But manhood is not a status to be achieved. It is a reputation to be maintained, for he can lose it at any time, largely by what he fails to do. Women, on the other hand, can lose their status as a lady by what she does. Not being sexually, responsible, things like that. The man can lose it at any time. Consider the captain of the Costa Concordia, that cruise ship where he abandoned. He lost his manhood immediately in that second with everybody who knows him and knows of him. Yes, maleness just happens. Maleness just happens. Manhood does not, and it cannot. The first, maleness, is a biological event. The second is a human developmental event. Masculinity is a character quality. That is why, and as I'll say a little bit later, toxic masculinity is an oxymoron. Toxic maleness, not so much. Simply put, manhood is not just found in what a boy learns to do and not do, but what he actually does and doesn't do. Manhood not demonstrated is not manhood at all. Manhood is only demonstrated in action and decisiveness. He cannot merely declare it. In fact, if he merely declares it, he becomes a joke. I'm a man just because I say I'm a man. It doesn't work that way. However, womanhood exists in her natural essence. It is hers to lose. She walks in the room with it just by the nature of being a woman. When manhood is not formed, cultivated, and acted upon, males fail to mature, resulting in the infamous phenomena of perpetual adolescence, failure to launch, living with my parents in their basement, and playing Fortnite 12 hours a day. Gender equity knows nothing of these phenomena. They are inherently and singly male problems. The first thing that we must understand about maleness is it doesn't naturally go in the direction that civilization requires. As Gilder says here, a man's body is full of undefined energies, and all of these energies need the guidance of culture. They require the expectation of women and the direction and encouragement of men. The development of manhood requires the expectation of women and the direction and encouragement of other men. The female nature tends to exist reliably among the medium scale of human behavior. The male nature is more oriented to one extreme or the other. As Camille Paglia says, and has commented, there are no female Mozarts because there are no female Jack the Rippers. Men can tend more toward the extreme, women live more reliably in the middle. Yes, it was one man who shot innocent concert goers in Las Vegas. Toxic manhood. But it was many men who ran toward danger to protect those who were wounded and being shot at. Masculinity. It was two men who flew two planes into the World Trade Center towers. It was hundreds of men who ran toward danger to rescue and care and protect. Nobody complained in either of those incidents about gender inequity. How come the men got to do all the rescuing? Why didn't they incorporate the parity of women as well? These things don't present themselves in the realness of life. They are, if we will, first world problems. Male energy, like I said, tends more to the extremes than femaleness. The second most important thing that we need to consider here is that manhood is not just crafted and refined. I'm sorry, that manhood must be crafted and refined in order to orient the male in a pro-social communitarian direction. The man in his own nature is not pro-social. In fact, this is the first task of every single society. Anthropologists have long told us that the original and most fundamental social problem of any culture is the unattached and unfettered male. Maleness is the fundamental and first social problem. Left to his own, he does not play well with others. Lord of the Flies is not a novel about the dark side of nature, of human nature. It is about the nature of raw, yet to be formed, maleness. And I contend if there had been one young lady on that island, the whole story would have worked out differently. Because she would have called the boys to a higher way of being and shamed those boys who acted like they did in the story. There's a reason why teens, male teens and male young adults pay higher life and auto insurance premiums. It's not because of prejudice. It's because of the way they actually act. He is not naturally disposed to make himself or anyone around him a better person. He is not likely to become other-focused, either fiercely physically and sexually competitive or pathetically indolent. He is more likely, unless acted upon by outside forces, to become or remain a social contagion. In Male and Female, Margaret Mead, and I like books incarnated, and so I like to bring the books and actually read from them. In Male and Female, Margaret Mead explains a central anthropological truth that manhood must be taught. She says, in every known human society, everywhere in the world, and such absolute language is seldom used by anthropologists. Everywhere in the world, the young male learns that when he grows up, one of the things which he must do in order to be a full member of society is to provide food and protection for some female and their common offspring. Every known human society rests firmly and singly on this learned, nurturing behavior of man. She also says, men have to learn to want to provide for others. And this behavior being learned, and this is the most important part, is fragile and can disappear rather easily under social conditions which no longer expect or teach it. That's a crazy idea. That could never happen. My goodness. In every known human society, the young male must be taught. Thus, across virtually all cultures, manhood largely consists in three learned and expected qualities: procreation, not just sex, but procreation, to invest in the next generation; provision for some woman and their common children; and their protection from the village and outside attackers. Those are the three P's: procreation, provision, and protection, the three P's of manhood. If the boy doesn't learn these, he is not likely to become a good, selfless, serving man, valuable to and respected by the community. Shame and derision will be his lot. We are a unique culture and a unique age in that that is not happening today. We are out of line with human experience and human nature. The third point that we must realize is that the most elemental destabilizing force in every culture is not just unrefined male energy, but his unchecked sexual energy, full stop. Male sexuality is the most consequential, potentially negative thing that any society can experience. In its fundamental essence, male sexuality is deeply antisocial, is inherently antisocial. It has no civilizing, pro-social nature in itself. To become so, it must be acted upon by other outside forces, primarily strongly enforced female and societal expectations. Women are the gatekeepers and the governors, if you will, of human sexuality. Ladies, that's power. By contrast, female sexual energy is inherently pro-social. There is not a social problem called too much female sexuality. Actually, it's a virtue when it is truly what it is. Female sexuality has the power to create and maintain not just new human life, but human civilization itself by being the moderating factor and power of the behavior of men. But it can only do this when there is societal appreciation for these very fundamental differences between male and female, which we know are under tremendous attack today. The unique feminine power among male sexuality is curiously and powerfully demonstrated in the nature of a relatively new social development, the long-term homosexual relationship. Now, we know among a group of conservative Christians, of course, the issue of homosexuality has to come up at some point. But I mean this as an example here, and it's very instructive. Many, perhaps most, gay men in long-term relationships develop and agree upon self-determined rules allowing for extracurricular sexual activity. This is beyond dispute. It is not controversial among gay men to acknowledge that they understand fidelity and monogamy as two different things. While monogamy means only having sex with one person, fidelity curiously means being faithful to the mutually agreed upon rules of the relationship. Such agreements are nearly non-existent in any relationship where women are present, including heterosexual and lesbian relationships. This phenomenon is well established in the academic literature, common enough to have gained an academic term or descriptor. It's called extradyadic sex. Extradyadic sex. One widely respected investigation from Rutgers University by its author, Michael LaSala, he's a gay man and publishes widely on this topic, he found that only a third of long-term gay couples had monogamous agreements and truly honored them with no outside sex. Only a third. In the openly non-monogamous relationships, LaSala reports that the frequency of sex outside the primary relationship from its inception ranged from 2 to a whopping 2,500 separate incidents of extradyadic sex. The median for the span of the relationship was 42 extracurricular experiences. Frequency in the previous year ranged from 0 to 350 occurrences of outside sex, with a median of 8. Among those who pledged true monogamy to one another, the range was from 1 to 63 slip-ups with a median of 5 over the life of the relationship. I don't say this as a moral judgment, if you will, among same-sex male relationships, only to point out an anthropological and human reality is that women are the governors, if you will, of sexuality. They determine what does and what does not happen, and they're usually not real keen when the husband says, "Honey, just hear me out. Might you be interested in us diversifying our sexual portfolio?" Men don't bring that up because they already know what the answer is. Without the essential tempering and socializing influence of female sexuality, male sexuality's nature and need is wholly another animal. The fourth is related to this heavily. It's the unavoidable point of the consequences of male sexuality. Andy Warhol infamously said, "Sex is the biggest nothing of all time." Of course, he was very wrong. Nothing happens without sex. This conference, did sex start it? Well, Mr. and Mrs. Kushner needed quite a few years ago to get busy doing something so that little Jimmy could be born and bring this conference about. And it needed people to attend it, so there were many mothers and fathers out there who many years ago needed to get busy to create all of you so that you could come here. Nothing happens without sex. Sex is profoundly consequential. Every society must give greater attention to this fact of the consequences of sexuality than it does to the need for food, shelter, and protection from outside forces. Let me say that again. Every society must give greater attention to this fact than it does to its need for food, shelter, and protection from outside sources, because unchecked sexuality is the thing internally that can bring it down or keep it from developing in the first place. These and all other vital needs are either enhanced or crippled by what a community expects of the relationship between a man, the children he sires, and the women he does so with. If it doesn't get this right, few other things, if anything, will be accomplished by that civilization. Of course, the male's attitude and approach toward his procreative act and possibilities are very distinct and different than hers are. His necessary participation in the act is solely orgasmic, and it only lasts for seconds. Beyond that, he's done in his basic male nature. He is not naturally connected to the potential of the act. The woman's connection, however, is profound and starts shortly after conception and intensifies daily. It costs her dearly in energy and in sleep and in overall comfort, starting long, long, long before the first pains of childbirth. She is inescapably invested in the next generation of humanity. He is not. He must be taught to be so. In Gilder's words, the crucial process of civilization is the subordination of male sexual impulses and biology to the long-term horizons of female sexuality. That's powerful. The prime fact of life is the sexual superiority of women. It is male behavior that must be changed in order to create a civilized order. Because, as we heard earlier from Gilder, unlike a woman, a man has no civilized role or agenda in his body. Getting male sexuality to bow to female sexuality is the first and most fundamental crucial process and requirement of every civilization. No society can develop or endure without succeeding at this. Female sexuality must be protected and honored. Male sexuality, on the other hand, must be corralled and harnessed. The fifth primary point is that the woman is not only the gatekeeper and stabilizing force of male sexuality, she is the authorizing factor in fatherhood, in patriarchy, in paternity. That, ladies and gentlemen, is power. If a particular man desires to be involved in the life of his child, it is the child's mother and she alone who determines whether and how he may do this. In the state of nature, his paternity is established by her fiat. She typically desires to make this relationship public by making the father of the child her husband. That's a human universal as an ideal. Anthropologists have called this cooperative act the principle of legitimization of the child. Speaking of legitimate children and illegitimate children is an anthropological term. It's not a moralistic term. Branislav Malinowski explains in his book, Sex, Culture, and Myth, he says this, the most important moral and legal rule concerning kinship is that no child should be brought into the world without a man, and one man at that, assuming the role of the sociological father, that is, the child's guardian and protector, the male link between the child and the rest of the community. I think that this generalization amounts to a universalized sociological law. There runs the rule that the father is indispensable for the full sociological status of the child. And it's the woman who bestows that and encourages that in the man. Consider the etymology of two important words, matrimony and husband. Matrimony, it comes from the Latin word matrimonium, which means literally obligation of the man to the mother, maternal. It is the man stepping up and committing himself to this woman and to their potential children to provide for that woman. Since it's virtually impossible for a mother and her child to thrive by themselves, a marriage arose in nearly every civilization. And it's interesting, anthropologists say nearly every civilization. You think, what are the ones that don't? We don't know what they are. So let me be absolute. In every human civilization, throughout time, the impregnating male, we have to find a way to bond him permanently and exclusively to this woman and not all these other women. He can no longer be a bumblebee. Thus, the good man steps up, and in doing so, he marries the woman and becomes a husband. That comes from the old Norse word, husband, house bond. It says, son, you are now bound to this household. This woman, these kids, that's your responsibility. All these over here, not so much. Society bonds that man and his sexuality and his energy and his life decisions to this woman and these children. A house bond. It is certainly no coincidence here. Now, this goes into the sociology of marriage and paternity. It is certainly no coincidence that the term feminization of poverty was coined as the sexual revolution initiated the great divorce between sex, babies, and marriage. Feminist scholar Diana Pierce, she's the one who coined that term. She introduced it in an important essay that she wrote in Urban and Social Change Review. She lamented, ironically, that while women were gaining large opportunities in the marketplace and in education and things like that, she says, quote, poverty is rapidly becoming a female problem. That was the opening line of her essay. Poverty is rapidly becoming a female problem because the economic status of women has declined over the past several decades. As they are gaining more opportunities in the marketplace, their economic welfare is declining. Ironic. She blamed the significant increase in the number of female-headed families. Ghettos are not created by city planners, crime by police, or is failing health created by big pharma? Each of these social ills arise by the inattention to the sexual behavior and consequences of the male. If he doesn't have to marry before he gets access to sex and potentially fathering children, guess what? He won't. And he hasn't, and he is not. Years ago, George Akerlof, who has dual appointments, or had them, he's retired now, at Georgetown and UC Berkeley, and is also a Nobel Prize-winning economist, he has demonstrated in an important paper how shotgun marriages decline precipitously at the advent of the pill and backed up by the legalization of abortion on demand. This was not coincidental. As women gained control over their own fertility, and in a general sense, I mean, that's a good idea, an empowering idea, and backed up by abortion, the young man had no longer an expectation to, quote unquote, do right by the girl. Akerlof added to this insight 2 years later in another important paper on how marriage changes and transforms the male for the better. He says this: men settle down when they get married. If they fail to get married, they fail to settle down. There is no question that there is a very large difference in behavior between the single man and the married man. And it's not just, as we saw in the homosexual example, that marriage or the commitment of relationship that changes men, but it's women through their power and through their expectations. In his very important book, Manhood in the Making, anthropologist David Gilmore, and if you're interested in this topic, I would read Men in Marriage by Gilder. I would read this as well and read the first couple of chapters. Manhood in the Making, the cultural concepts of masculinity. He says, one of my findings here is that manhood ideologies always include a criterion and an expectation for selfless generosity, even to the point of sacrifice. Again and again, he says, we find that real men are those who give more than they take away. They give more than they consume. They serve others. Real men are generous even to a fault. Non-men are often those stigmatized as stingy and unproductive. It's interesting. My wife and I, we have 5 kids. When the kids were younger, you know, they would ask mom for some money and she'd say, I don't have any money, go ask your dad. And I would tell them to go into my wallet and they can have all the money there they find. Okay? Dads do not have any money in their wallets. I used my debit card purely for gas. That was like the only purchase that I ever made. Men give more than they take away. A good man is a fountain, not a drain. For he is, for a very specific set of people, the provider. The formation of such men is the first task, as we said, of human civilization, and its greatest threat when it is ignored. I conclude with this. The pressing question is this: how can we recover manhood today? Let me not pretend. That is a big, big question. And there are no easy answers. Because we have strayed so far from that idea in the culture today. It's hard for all the king's men and all the king's horses to put the Humpty Dumpty of manhood back together again. But we as a people need to come together and figure out how to do that. And it must be encouraged by the women, but it must be undertaken by the men. It is only men who can teach this, and it's only women who can demand it. So let me leave you with just a few key thoughts in conclusion. Manhood must be taught, and it can only grow in the direction of procreating provision and protection for a wife, his offspring, and the community around him when it is taught. It is not natural. It is a cultural construct. A man must learn to produce more than he consumes and learns to seek the good of others before himself. Thus, true masculinity is not and can never be toxic. Correct people when they say that. There is no such thing as toxic masculinity. There is certainly toxic maleness, but not toxic masculinity. Masculinity is a social virtue, a personal characteristic. How do we know? Set a young woman up on a date. She asks you about this young gentleman, and her girlfriends say, well, he's very masculine. No woman says, well, is he getting help for that? We are confusing masculinity with macho-ness. Masculinity has no pathological characteristics. It is pro-social. It is pro-other. Manhood does not exist in passivity or stasis. It only exists in action. It must be demonstrated. It is not conceptual. Manhood is never assumed. It must be demonstrated and it must be proven in order to be actual. Healthy manhood is largely centered on what he does and what he does not do with his sexuality and with the weakest and most vulnerable around him. There are many definitions for masculinity and manhood. I use this one and I like this one. A man does the right thing at the right time in the right way for the right reasons. There's a lot of rights in there. Margaret Mead says this, and I love this quote. It is true that women create humanity, but only men can create manhood. The crafting of manhood is not only essential to every society, it is the foundation upon which it is built. This is not because men are more powerful than women, but in many ways, quite the opposite. They are the most human. They are the most pro-social. Women are the most formative. And ask any group of married men and women, if women make men better men, and the audience will laugh at you. Not because it's a stupid point, but because it's obvious. Men, how many of you are better men today and doing what you're doing because there was some woman in your life that made demands of you? It's true across all. Some of you didn't raise your hands. This is true across all human civilization. And I would like to end with just this personal story. My wife and I, we met in high school. I was a surfer and a skater, and my rule was anything that got in the way of surfing and skating was bad. I just keep my dad off my back, tried as hard as I could just to get C's, okay? So my wife and I met in high school. She falls in love with this surfer skater guy. And we get married, and about 2 years into our marriage, she says, Glenn, we're gonna have kids. I want our kids to live in their own home. Own means you've got to own it. You've got to buy it. I'm not going to buy it. If you're gonna do that, you cannot continue to work in the warehouse where you work. You're most likely gonna have to go to school and get an education. And I did. I said, yes, ma'am. And I never would have imagined, quite honestly, that I would be here today speaking at this seminary, this university, speaking to a group of folks like you. And it was one influence that did that. Of course it was Christ, but Christ used one woman to create that. And he has done that, and God has done that through all human civilizations. Women shape and create men. And for all the power, for all the influence that they can develop and that they can demonstrate, that is the most powerful of all, because it does nothing less than create human civilization and maintain human civilization itself. Thank you.